Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene! Gene Fodor!
Gene, what's good?
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
Welcome to Stuff from the Science Lab from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey guys, and welcome to the podcast. This is Allison Loudermilk, the science editor from HowStuffWorks.com.
And this is Robert Lamb, science writer from HowStuffWorks.com.
And we hope you caught the first part of our series on world-changing experiments, because it was world-changing.
Yep.
And exciting. And mentioned some good stuff. And today we're going to continue with a couple more experiments.
Yep. You're changing the world once more.
One experiment at a time.
Yeah. So the first one that we're talking about is primordial soup, which does not come in a bowl. Though if it did, it would probably be pretty gross.
Yeah.
Yeah. And here's why. This boils down to the theory that at one point, there was no life on Earth.
Okay.
It was prebiotic, okay? And you just had the chemicals for life floating around out there. You know, you had especially proteins and nucleic acids. And these were formed, you know, early in Earth's primordial environment.
Okay.
Okay. So all the elements are there, right? It just needs to be cooked. So the theory was that something, say, like a strike of lightning or radiation from the sun sort of, you know, cooked the thing, set the thing off, got everything rocking.
Okay.
And you know, was the catalyst for life.
Yeah, and a couple of biochemists in particular, John Haldane and Alexander Oparin, came up with this idea. And what do you know? A few decades later, in 1953... Harold Urey and Stanley Miller obliged and tested their hypothesis.
Yeah. And of course, how do you test something like that? Well, you just have to make an artificial environment with the same, you know, chemical properties.
Right. Basically, they were intent on recreating the early atmosphere of Earth in a carefully controlled closed system. Does that blow your mind for a second?
Yeah.
Recreating the early atmosphere of Earth?
Like it sounds like...
In a beaker.
It sounds like something from like Outer Limits or Twilight Zone. It's like they've created like the past in a little bubble, and they're going to make life evolve, and it's like Sand Kings or something, you know?
It's just so cool, and it's so simple. Right, so they had a warm flask of water as the ocean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and water vapor rose up from the water, collected in another chamber. They introduced hydrogen, methane, ammonia, all this to stimulate an oxygen-free atmosphere.
Right. And then what do you know? They discharge a couple sparks.
Yeah.
Representing lightning, of course.
They had to wait for lightning to strike the clock tower at the center of town. But then they had that run to their experiment.
No. No Back to the Future reference. But they did a couple
just
sparks.
Just a spark. Just a few sparks.
Discharged a couple sparks into the mixture of gases. And finally, the condenser cooled the gases into a liquid they collected for analysis.
And they opened it up, and there was a whole beaver in there. No, not a whole beaver. No, but organic compounds, right?
And that was very exciting. Almost as exciting as a beaver. Yeah, the organic compounds were abundant in the cooled liquid. What did he find in particular that excited Miller a whole bunch?
In particular, they found amino acids, which are a vital component for life as we know it.
Right. So Urey and Miller concluded that organic molecules could form in an oxygen-free atmosphere and that the simplest of living things might not be far behind.
Yeah, there you go. That's world-changing. That's basically like the smoking gun, you know, for evolution, if you will.
Yeah, it's excellent. It's such a cool experiment. So let's talk about making light.
Yeah, this one's really cool. And it's not really making light. Like,
it's more measuring light.
Yeah, more measuring light. Kind of like capturing light. It's kind of almost like, you know, I'm going to grab a beam of light and like force it to run a whole bunch of laps. And I'm going to watch it, measure what it's doing. And by measuring it, figure out exactly how fast it's going.
Right. So light was still a mystery back when the 19th century dawned. And it inspired a couple of fascinating experiments, most notably Thomas Young's double slit experiment. But the one that we're going to talk about had to do with a gentleman by the name of A.A. Michelson, a physics instructor who in 1878 devised an experiment to calculate the speed of light.
Yeah.
I love this. I mean, can you not? This is so cool.
Well, it's also so big. You know, anytime there's a big experiment, it's kind of cool.
Yeah. But it also was fairly simple. And I think he made it with materials that cost less than $10. I don't know what the equivalent amount would be back then, but he made it pretty cheaply. And what Michelson did was he proved that light was a finite measurable quantity.
Yeah, he basically set up a couple of mirrors, about in a mile long tube. All right. So the light hit one of these mirrors and then reflected towards the other mirror. And this mirror was rotating.
Mm-hmm. When the speed was correctly adjusted, light reflected from the rotating mirror, struck a mirror that was in the fixed position, and it returned to strike the next face on the spinning mirror. So do you have a picture of that? You have light striking the rotating mirror, then it's going back to the fixed mirror, and then it's going back again to the rotating mirror.
Right, and he had an observation screen set up as well, so he could measure these things.
So according to the University of Chicago, they did a little write-up on this experiment. The time needed for the next face to rotate into position to reflect the light was the time required for the light to travel the known distance to the stationary mirror. Basically, if you know how fast the rotating mirrors are rotating and you know the distance between those two sets of mirrors, then you can figure out the speed of light.
Yeah. He set up the situation where math could calculate it. And he came really close, as I recall.
Yeah, he came within 200 miles of the actual value. Yeah, so more important, scientists had a better picture of light and a foundation upon which to build the theories of quantum mechanics and relativity.
Yeah, with the speed of light, you know, without understanding the speed of light, there are so many theories about the universe we wouldn't have. Listen to any of our podcasts that deal with space and, you know, and big cosmological issues. And
speed of light has a way of coming up a lot.
It does. And so does radiation. Which our next experiment is concerned with, correct?
Yeah, let's head to France. Let's head to the Curies. So the year 1897 was a pretty momentous one for Marie Curie. She had a first child with her husband Pierre, also a renowned scientist. And a few weeks later, she went looking for a subject for her doctoral thesis. And what she settled on was uranium rays, which were first described by Henri Becquerel. And so Becquerel had discovered that these rays accidentally because he left uranium salts in a dark room. And when he came back, he found that they had exposed a photographic plate.
I love that story. It's so like simple and accidental, you know?
Yeah.
And he's just leaving uranium lying around the house. That's always good.
So Marie chose to study these mysterious rays, and she wanted to see if there were other elements that gave off similar emissions.
And she found them. Yeah, she discovered polonium. Which is named for Poland.
Her homeland.
Yeah. And then she also discovered radium. So those are pretty, and also she really narrowed down that you had radioactive compounds, but it wasn't the compound that was radioactive. It was an element in the compound.
Right. Yeah. And so Curie won 2 Nobel Prizes for her work.
Quite a gal.
Quite a scientist.
But let's talk about dogs. This I think is more exciting. And I think everyone's more or less familiar with this one, if not the actual experiment. They're
familiar
with what it means.
From the cartoon, Pavlov. Wasn't there a cartoon about Pavlov?
Like the likes of Scooby-Doo or something?
No, a cartoon that ran in the Sunday newspaper. That's like a Marmaduke.
Like a Marmaduke.
You know there's going to be a Marmaduke movie, by the way.
I saw this. Crazy. Because I love the idea of Marmaduke because it's like, it's not really funny and like everyone is the same. It's like, oh my God, goodness, the dog's so big. Look how huge that dog is. And it's like the same thing every time. And it's so bad. It's awesome. You know?
Yeah. It reminds me of Family Circus where, did you ever read Family Circus? Maybe it was before your time. I used to read the comics. And there was that one comic that, the whole joke was the child was asking what was for dinner and said Paschetti and meatballs.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. That was the joke. Paschetti and meatballs.
Then he like, just specifically, or did he like milk that joke for like 20 years? Like some of these
guys. I think
guys
that
did.
Cartoon was pretty popular. I think I might have even seen it posted up at my dentist's office.
Wow.
Yeah. So anyway, back to Pavlov, the Russian-born physiologist and chemist responsible for the salivating dogs experiment.
So Pavlov had already noted that the stomach won't start digesting without salivation occurring first.
Right. He wasn't actually interested in psychology or behavior. He was interested in the bodily functions, digestion and blood circulation.
Yeah. So the experiment itself involved feeding dogs.
Yeah. It did.
And, like, having a whole bunch of flashing lights and noises going on at the same time. And then you feed them without those noises or the lights, et cetera. But then you don't feed them, but hit the lights, and they start salivating anyway.
Indeed.
Like they're about to be fed.
Right, a conditioned reflex.
Yeah. And so it's like, you know, you hear people talking about something having a Pavlovian effect.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like I have a certain ringtone that goes off in the morning that wakes me up.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's like a response. It's like, oh, goodness, I have to get out of bed.
So if you were to hear that ringtone at other times of
the
day,
I hear like occasionally somebody in the office will have that ringtone go off. And my heart jumps. And I'm like, oh, my goodness, I just dreamed half my day and I'm not really out of bed yet.
Well, the interesting thing that Pavlov found was that this type of reflex, like you're running for the shower when you hear that ringtone,
mm-hmm.
It dies out if the stimulus is wrong too often. So if you hear it in the office too much, then you're not going to have that urge.
So if he pulled this on the dogs too much, they'd be like, hey, I don't actually get fed every time you sound an air horn. You know, so.
The canines got smart.
Huh.
And Pavlov published his results in 1903. A year later, he won a Nobel Prize in Medicine, but it wasn't for his work with conditioning, but rather in recognition of his work on the physiology of digestion, through which knowledge on vital aspects of the subject has been transformed and enlarged. That comes to you, compliments of the NobelPrize.org site, which is such an awesome site. Have you been to the Nobel Prize?
I have. It's pretty cool.
Site?
Yeah.
It contains a wealth of information. I just love it.
The other great thing about this experiment is that aside from maybe being a little freaked out by the noise, like nobody was like mean to a dog or any kind of an animal, you know? I mean, not really mean, you know, just kind of messing with them a little, but no more than your average dog owner might do.
It wasn't like vivisection.
Yeah, like so many of these animal experiments, it's like even if it's for a good cause, it's like you're like, oh man, you're going to blast another chimp into space. That's great.
So really he didn't do anything? He didn't engage in any animal cruelty? I don't know.
The experiment itself is what I'm saying. The experiment itself is not overtly based in animal cruelty, as some experiments definitely are.
Right. I guess it depends on your definition of animal cruelty, but...
Oh, there's some experiments that are definitely animal cruelty.
Well, some might classify this one as.
Well, but it's a far cry from, say, cutting a dog's head off and then trying to sew another dog's head onto the stump.
Like, right,
like
right,
that's
indeed.
A little butcherous in my mind.
There is a disparity between the two. So let's talk about authority figures.
Yeah, let's move on to more human cruelty, because that's what this experiment centers around.
And Stanley Milgram. This is a pretty famous experiment. I'm sure you guys have heard of it. Yeah, his 1960s obedience experiments. And they're some of the most famous and controversial science experiments. So what did Milgram do?
Yeah, so basically, you know, he's sitting around his laboratory and he was thinking, you know what I would like to do? I would like to know how far ordinary people will go in delivering painful electric shocks to a friend or peer when commanded to by a scientific authority.
Can you imagine? That's his laboratory thought.
Yeah.
Just sitting there musing upon the newspaper's headlines, and then his thoughts wander over to...
Yeah, or he has like a lab assistant and he's like, how far would this idiot go if I just told him to do it? And as we find out, pretty far.
Yeah.
It's kind of disturbing.
Right. So this was his experiment. Milgram recruited a couple of volunteers, just ordinary folk, to deliver the shocks. He recruited the actors to be the subjects who would receive the shocks.
Yeah, so there's no actual shocking going on. They're just pretending to be shocked. But the people that are employing the shock don't know it.
Here, pretend I just gave you a shock.
Ah!
Okay, I amped the...
Jerry's listening in on the headphones. If I scream into the headphone, I mean into the mic, she's gonna be mad at us.
Right, so you have your actors, you have your ordinary residents, and then you have an authority figure, a scientist who would remain in the room for the study's duration.
Yeah.
And the authority figure was the one who began each experiment. They showed the volunteers how to use the mock shock machine. That's a good name, the mock shock machine. The machine allowed the volunteers to deliver up to 450 volts, which was a shock labeled as highly dangerous. What happened next?
So next, the scientists told the volunteers that they were testing to see how shocks might improve word association recall, which... I don't know why they fell for that, because it's kind of like, oh man, I stuck my finger in that light sock and I'm totally better with my vocabulary. So I instructed the volunteers to shock the learners, who again were actors, for wrong answers and to raise the voltage as this experiment progressed.
Oh man.
Yeah.
And so the learners cried out whenever they received a shock, and at about 150 volts, they would demand to be freed. Well, the scientists, the authority figure, encouraged volunteers to continue delivering the shocks no matter how agitated the learners became.
Yeah, some of the volunteers stopped at about 150 volts, but most kept going until they reached a maximum shock level of a 450. It's crazy.
It is crazy.
So, yeah, the lesson here then is that if a scientific authority figure tells somebody to do something, you can really push them pretty far. You know?
Yeah, the power of authority, most definitely. A lot of people later called into question the ethics of the experiment, as you might guess.
Mm-hmm.
But the results were really fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, it's often overshadowed by some of the crueler psychological experiments, like the Stanford Prison experiment.
The Stanford Prison experiment. Yeah. Didn't they have to call that one off early?
I forget how that went.
Yeah. So we have a ton of really good experiment articles on the site. If you want to check them out on the homepage, we have
How Human Experimentation Works. That's a pretty good one.
Yeah, we have 5 Crazy Government Experiments. And we also have this one that Bill Harris wrote on 10 Science Experiments to Change the World.
And if you want to hear about even more experiments, do check out our blog, because we're always covering experiments there, because they're constantly doing something fascinating out there in the world of science. And we like to cover the really snazzy ones.
Yeah, and a lot of times we'll cover them on Twitter or Facebook as well, if we don't get around to posting on them or written an article.
Yeah, that's Lab Stuff on Twitter, and in Facebook you can look up Lab Stuff or Stuff from the Science Lab, and you will find us.
And of course, if any of you guys are listening or in the labs, we'd love to hear what you're up to, so send us an email at sciencestuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Want more How Stuff Works? Check out our blogs on the howstuffworks.com homepage.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene! Gene Fodor!
Gene, what's good?
But be careful, Because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
My whole life, I've been told this one story about my family, about how my great-great-grandmother was killed by the mafia back in Sicily. I was never sure if it was true, so I decided to find out. And even though my Uncle Jimmy told me I'd only be making the vendetta worse, I'm going to Sicily anyway. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.